So today I'm joined by JP, and JP is a founder working in the Bitcoin space, and he is building some really cool products. And I've taken a look at what he's doing, and I'm really, really super excited to have him here. So JP, welcome to Blockchain and Beyond. Would you like to just introduce yourself to the people and talk about what you do?
Thanks for having me. My name is JP Barrick, and I run a company called Mining Store. At Mining Store, we convert energy to wealth through cryptocurrency mining. And we do this by locating all across the Midwest, specifically in Iowa, where we build 5 MW facilities on behalf of clients and for ourselves. We run the machines for these clients. If you don't know the world of Bitcoin mining, it requires tons of ASIC computers, which are dedicated servers that can only mine Bitcoin, and they require 24/7 operational support, efficiency, and always need to be connected to the internet running and mining Bitcoin. So happy to jump into it and super excited to talk about why I got into Bitcoin, why I got into mining, and my journey through crypto.
Yeah, great. I guess we'll sort of start from your journey to crypto because obviously I'm guessing, you just didn't wake up one day and say, "Hey, I'm gonna build a mining store." I'm sure you've got a story to tell. So would you mind sharing how you sort of got into this space?
Sure. So I woke up in 2013 and was like, Bitcoin, what a concept, separating money from state, really changing the ideas we have of digital value and like what it means to use a market or a network to transact value. And I started reading about the Byzantine generals problem and all these crazy, things why and how Bitcoin succeeds and why it's important. And from there, I started trading some altcoins, and this was 2013. So we had like Dogecoin coming out, and it was really popular, Litecoin, all those. And then I realized, what do I want to do to impact this space? And so I was in the computer security, computer science, that type of background and world. And so then I started Mining Store in 2016. So between 2013 and 2016, I was buying Butterfly Lab ASICs or some ASICs that were coming out and looking to mine in my parents' house, and ended up buying some GPU rigs and mining there and adding a new circuit. And then went and got an investment from my grandparents, my mom and dad, myself, all put up capital to buy 300 GPUs that were going to mine Ethereum. So we started mining Ethereum, mining over 500 Ethereum a day at that point. And we're just mining it and then selling some of it for the power and holding the rest of it and saying, okay, where is this going to go? No idea. And then as you buy all these GPUs, you're like, okay, how do we make some money, maybe selling this equipment or providing a full service? And then we launched a Shopify store. So from there, we launched a Shopify store and, started selling computer rigs, buying them from one spot and selling them on another with the GPUs and being a middleman in the market there. And as I learned how to run and operate these facilities, we then started scaling out to working with other investors to run them in like Washington, Oregon. We ended up moving the facility up to Washington, Oregon. Ended up building a project with a solar farm company in California in a biodiverse area in a reserve, and chopping it down and mining Bitcoin right there just so they can get their tax credits. So we ended up solving a lot of these random problems that people had the opportunity to work with the Sacramento Kings and develop a mining for good opportunity where we would mine for Ethereum and other coins in their data center inside their stadium, and then those coins would be donated to different charities around the world. Disclosure, sadly, some of that got caught up in FTX bankruptcy, but you can't win them all. So yeah, I've helped with all of these projects, and now in Iowa, I focus on running a team of individuals, network technicians, people that keep these facilities running. And we have 3 facilities currently, and we're building out another 2 more facilities between now and the end of the month of August. So it's been a fun journey of building facilities and kind of locating these unique spots in the world where energy prices are cheap. Taxes in Iowa, there's no data center tax for property, so that's one of the reasons why we're there. And supporting the Bitcoin network. So it's a long-winded question to how I got into this space and my journey through this market.
Yeah, no, awesome. It seems that you've got quite an extensive background, starting, I think the fact that you mentioned, mining Ethereum, just shows how long you've been doing it, because Ethereum's moved on from proof of work. There's no longer mining involved with Ethereum, so I think most people will recognize that you've been around for quite a while. And it's interesting how you've helped to solve these problems, or you've been doing mining for good in facilities that would otherwise be wasting their power, their energy. Facilities that are running anyway, we may as well make the most of what they have. And I think that's really interesting. But I took a look at your website, and I looked a bit into what you do. But now you guys sort of offer Bitcoin mining as a service for anyone who wants to get into the space, right?
So that's correct. Yeah. So one of the reasons, as I mentioned, starting that Shopify store, I wanted to share and allow people to get into mining and to join me on the experience. And, when I was starting off, I was like, okay, I can make, some money selling the hardware. And now it's more about, okay, we can diversify our operations. And as we increase the amount of hash rate we have under management, which is the measurement we use to determine the speed of the computers, that is going to increase the bottom line of the business and allow us to staff more, great technicians in the area. And so that's why I moved down that route. And so now we've separated out into three really good programs. So we have managed mining, which is for anyone who wants a hands-off solution where we are custodying the Bitcoin, we're paying the power bills, we're paying you out every month at the end of the month in Bitcoin. There's no spare parts, there's no tech hours being billed. This is a really a profit-sharing model where we're able to, mine Bitcoin with you and have provided a white glove solution. So that's the first product we developed, really targeting people who want to invest anywhere from $50,000 and up. And then we also help build facilities and sell those facilities and operate them for larger clients investing anywhere between $5 and $10 million into these small 5 MW sites in Iowa where they can invest, own that site, and we then operate it. And the third project is one that I've been working on for a while. We recently, or last year, did a launch with Josh Terry with something called BitVault. And the intention of BitVault is the ability to get anyone into mining, literally anyone at $100 a price tag or a stock price. And that gets them ownership in a Bitcoin mining company that's really well defined. And so because we use something called the regulated crowdfunding exemption that allows us to sell and talk about these projects, these securities. And so for Josh Terry BitVault, we raised this money. We raised up to $600,000 from over 1,000 different investors all across the world. And then we ended up going and buying Bitcoin miners, giving those investors Bitcoin mining exposure, where we're now going to be extracting new Bitcoin. The nice thing about these vehicles is that any influencer can do them. And so I myself am starting my own JP Barrick BitVault as well this year coming up. And that offering will be on WeFunder, but it's a similar principle of, you can buy in at a minimum of $100 and you can own a stock in a mining company with a clear schedule on management fees, a clear allocation of where the capital is going to go, and then a clear distribution schedule. One thing we've seen in going into this is, like most crowdfunding examples, you're going to be investing in equity and you might get your money back and it's a great idea. And there's nothing wrong with those, but we're really trying to change it up where you're looking at this crowdfunding investment as a dividend that's paid consistently and that's defined before you invest the money. And there's very few companies in that space that are approaching it like that. But I believe there's a huge opportunity for renewable energy projects, real estate projects, mining projects to come in and use this model, influencers to use this model to raise money for projects that develop or throw off cash flow because they're infrastructure based and not necessarily idea based or this new product that's going to change the market.
Yeah, no, I think it's quite interesting that you mentioned Josh Terry, because I'm actually familiar with the project he's working on, because I follow him on social media. I didn't know that you guys were the ones behind it. So I guess that's pretty cool. And yeah, making Bitcoin mining accessible is probably something that's really important, because someone looking to get into Bitcoin mining themselves, sure, they can mine on their own computer. It might not be efficient. But if they wanted to, even invest in an ASIC miner, that could be, perhaps $1,000, $2,000, at the very baseline, not considering, cost for cooling and electricity and, operating costs, the time it takes to set up the miner and maintain it. There's a lot of effort that goes into it. So, I think providing this sort of solution for people is one that is going to be really key. But for people who, you know, aren't too familiar with Bitcoin, you know, what sort of benefit does mining provide aside from, you know, generating you some Bitcoin?
Sure. So Bitcoin mining is the only way that new Bitcoins enter into the market. So there's no other ways to get Bitcoin other than through mining it. And then once the new coin's created, it can be traded, you know, across the network on exchanges. So Bitcoin miners play two roles. One, as you mentioned, extracting new currency. The second one is moving transactions or approving transactions across the network, making sure no one is doing something, as we know, called a double spend attack. And so that is what a Bitcoin miner's job is at the protocol level when it comes to how we work with the other parts of the protocol. As a miner, we're always searching for the next block or the next hash, and that gets harder every 2 weeks, depending on if other people are joining. And so, you know, that makes this industry very competitive, because if your competitor is plugging machines in, they're going to be getting Bitcoins that you used to be getting, and they're going to take up more of your share. So you always have to be growing, always have to be deploying more capital in order to keep your Bitcoin production steady. And then we have the halving event as well, which, as you mentioned, price of running these machines is a core component to the return of the investment, because all you're doing is you're taking energy and you're putting out heat, and that energy has a price. And so the price we pay in Iowa is different than the price I would pay here in Austin, with the price that you pay in London. And so we're giving people exposure through Bitvault to that lower priced energy. And that's really, you know, getting on the bottom floor and building your own infrastructure. Owning that allows us to be able to provide lower power costs. So that's a huge crucial component to operating, because energy is anywhere between 40 to 80% of your cost, depending on the efficiency of that machine. It's not the technicians that cost a lot of money, it's the energy that each one of these machines consumes and the cost of that energy. And so that's what a Bitcoin miner does, and some of the outputs required to run it, as you mentioned, heat and noise. So you don't want to run this in your house. Like, even in the closet, I walked by a hotel closet, I heard a fan running. I was like, oh, is that a miner fan? Like, putting my ear up to it, like, oh no, wrong fan. But it's just like crazy how much, you know, when you hear those fans whirling, making money, you know the printer's going.
Yeah, no, for sure. You know, I want to touch on something else you mentioned is, you know, you're building facilities that are 5 megawatts. What sort of scale is that for you know, for people to understand, you know, what sort of scale you're working at? If you have an example on hand.
So the best example I have is a microwave. A microwave uses about 3,000 kilowatts when it's running. And
Okay.
so we have about in one of these, each one of our containers, we have 88 microwaves running. And then those containers, we have 20 containers on one of these sites. So you can do the math really quickly. It's like over 1,000, 300, 1,000, 500, 1,000, 600, depending, you know, depending on the size, and microwaves running 24/7. So when we go to an electric grid, we're anywhere between 1% and 5% of that grid in local Iowa. So, you know, they're at 100 megawatts of power, 1,000, 100,000 kilowatts. We're at 5,000 kilowatts, and we're running 24/7. And then we're actually turning on and off when the energy prices are not advantageous for us to buy. So most of our contracts are moving towards what we call flexible energy market-based pricing. And so that means that instead of having a flat rate for the energy, we have a rate that fluctuates based on the market. And Iowa is one of the interesting places, because it's the top, it's the most wind penetration or most renewable penetration out of any state by percentage. Now, Texas has more output in terms of megawatt, but by percentage, Iowa is the highest wind and solar penetration, which means that you see opportunities in the market where you actually get paid to use the energy, because this energy is subsidized. So solar and wind power in the middle of the night, when the energy in the grid and there's no one that wants to buy it, we go into something called a negative priced hour for that energy or for that LMP. And when we're buying that energy at a negative priced hour, not only are we making money mining Bitcoin, but we're also making money buying the energy. And so it kind of flips it all on its head. You're like, whoa, I can get paid to use energy. And yes, because if you're able to get from the market power, and you're able to take away the risk from the utility, where, you know, hey, if the market's really high, I'm going to turn off and I'm going to get paid. So that's the next thing. It's like, because you're committing to using this energy every day, you become a resource, which we call a stable or load. It's a stable resource that we know we can count on always using energy every day. You can't count on a hospital or your house to always use energy. And so when you have a stable load, you're able to bid that into the market. And then if someone else says, hey, I actually want to use that energy, I'm willing to pay you for your right to use it, then we can say, sure, we'll sell you back our right. Let's say we bought it for, you know, let's say we bought it for $50 and they want to buy it for 90 or 100. Well, then we'll do the calculation and say, are we going to make more money Bitcoin mining or more money turning off and selling our energy? And sometimes it makes sense to turn off and sell back the right we have to buy that energy to the market and get paid for being off. So what industry can you be in that you get paid to use energy and get paid not to use it and get paid while you're using it? And that's Bitcoin mining in a nutshell. That's why I love it, because it's so complicated and so intertwined in the energy markets and in our world. Mm-hmm. And it's been a journey to learn how to set up all those contracts and find those places with that.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, one thing people probably don't realize is that, you know, the negative pricing of energy is actually something that, you know, energy providers are willing to do. And that sort of comes down to how energy is actually produced. You know, energy is produced on demand. The best, you know, example I can think of is, you know, if there's, you know, a popular show on TV, when, you know, the commercial break hits, everyone, you know, at least in the UK, is going to go put the kettle on and make a cup of tea or a cup of coffee, you know. So, you know, the energy providers are expecting there to be a spike in power usage. And because power is so difficult to store, you have to create it on demand. And, you know, it takes some time for that energy production to actually ramp up. So in most cases, you know, these energy companies are trying to shoot above the expectations, because if they're shooting below, that means there's going to be some homes without power, which in today's day and age, especially, you know, in the US or in the UK, is like unheard of. So a lot of these energy providers are actually sort of, it's costing them to actually produce the energy they're making, because there's no one to actually buy it. But when you have someone that is, you know, a steady load, it's sort of, again, a flexible thing, where in some cases they may have more energy that they can give you, and there will be some cases where they have less. So, you know, they have that flexibility, which allows them to sort of stabilize the grid for the rest of, you know, the population. And that's why they can sort of afford to pay you to use the electricity, because they don't want to turn off their systems at night, because to turn it back on may take another 5, 10, 15, 20 minutes. And in that time, you can't have people without power. So it is a very, very complex, you know, system. And, you know, I think, you know, Bitcoin mining does play a very significant part in it. You know, I think it was, you know, a year or two ago during the summers in, I think, Texas, you know, some of the Bitcoin mining facilities there, they actually turned off their miners to allow extra capacity for the grid, so people could run their air conditioning units and so on. You know, so there's actually this sort of give and take, which is in favor of both the Bitcoin miners, but also the energy grid and the local governments, because they know, you know, that these guys will always buy energy from us. You know, they always want this much, and if we can give it to them, great. And if we can't, they don't really mind, because, you know, it builds into their system. So, you know, it is a very complex system that I think most people don't think of or aren't exposed to when they hear about Bitcoin mining. So yeah, I just think it's really cool how it all sorts of fits together. It's like a giant puzzle.
It is like a giant puzzle. I'll add a few things to what you mentioned. So the reason why we have negative prices in Iowa is because of the tax credits that come with renewable energy. And when you think about renewable energy, there's no fuel. So there's no, the cost to produce the every energy, or the levelized cost to produce the energy, is lower than if you have natural gas or coal or nuclear, or not natural gas or coal, where you need a lot of fuel, you know, to make that happen. So that's why we see these negatively priced hours. And you're exactly right. When the coffee pots are going and the tea is brewing, they're asking us to turn off to meet that demand, because it's faster. We can react in under 2 minutes, 1 minute, boom, we get a signal. We're down, we're off, because everything's internet connected. We have thousands of servers we're turning down. And that type of granularity and control allows a grid operator to save them tons of money on their overall cost, because when they are using energy at the peak, 15 minutes every month for most energy operators, that everyone gets a massive bill for whatever you're using at that 15 minute peak if you are on a time of use rate. But if you're not aware of, oh, I can't use energy at 6 p.m. on a Friday night, you know, when it's all hot, when I'm running my AC, you know, that's going to cost me, like when the power prices in the UK were going crazy, that could have, you know, to make that tea could have cost you $20. Like the amount of energy, the amount of that cost of that energy went crazy. And so when you start thinking about it that way, you're like, holy crap, like I want to be able to have cheap priced energy always. And that's something that society, you know, we've desired, we've built out, we spent years and years and tons of money building all this infrastructure, but developing nations don't necessarily have that. And so what they're doing with Bitcoin mining for these developing nations is they're helping them build a dam and then use the Bitcoin mining to pay for the extra capacity of the dam, to use the extra capacity of the dam. And so when the community grows into the full size of the dam, they've already been making money from that energy versus it's just going to waste in the community using a small amount of energy, because there are benefits of scale with energy. And as you scale, you get more economics and better economics.
Yeah, you know, now I want to sort of move it to a point you mentioned about like renewable energy credits, right? When I think a lot of people think about Bitcoin mining, they think, you know, burning coal, burning natural gas. But, you know, this was a couple of years ago, I think 2020 or 2021. I read a paper from Cambridge University where they looked at, you know, where the energy is actually coming from for Bitcoin mining. And, you know, it said, so it looked at it, I think globally. So it looked at it in the US, it looked at it in like Asia and China, because Bitcoin mining was still very big in that region. And, you know, in the US and also in China, you know, they saw that 2/3 of the energy was from renewable sources. And, you know, that is a very, very large amount. Most countries, you know, like even US to UK, don't run on 2/3 of renewable energy. So, you know, I think there is sort of perhaps a bit of a misconception about, you know, how Bitcoin mining works. You know, Bitcoin mining is effectively using, you know, just excess energy that the grid, you know, can't support. And if that energy is coming from a renewable source, there is no waste product, you know, and I think that, you know, maybe you could touch on that a bit.
Yeah, so the grid is a complicated system of electrons. And the problem when we get to renewable energy versus non-renewable energy is we don't know where the electron came from. You know, you basically put it in this mattress and it's electrified and it can come out any side of the mattress. You don't know, just like water, you don't know where it's going to go. You don't know what drop came in the beginning and what drop came out the end. And so the same thing applies to electricity here. But when we build our grids, we need base load power, and we need power that is, you know, going to lower the cost of energy for everyone. And so renewable energy, because it's subsidized and because it doesn't have a fuel, can generate energy at a lower cost than natural gas and coal, because it does have a fuel, which means that as a grid operator, you're balancing this balancing act of, okay, do I call the coal plant today? Do I ask them to turn on? And so every day in the market, what happens is the resources, the energy assets, bid into the market what they're willing to sell the energy for. Then the market operator, at least here in the US, they say, we're going to pick you up to meet our demand of what we think all the people in the market need. And if there's an imbalance, then they can come to people like us and say, hey, turn off, or go to other people and be like, hey, we really need you to turn on right now. We're going to pay you a lot more. But effectively, what happens is the wind and solar guys, they bid in the market lower. They get picked up every day because they, you know, they're getting the tax credits and they want to sell the power. But the natural gas and coal guys start getting pushed out of the market, which provides this natural incentive to move towards renewables. And it just the market, you know, playing itself out. We help wind and solar become more penetrable in the area, because now the prices that they're getting on the energy go from, you know, let's say negative 20 to now only being negative 10, because we can suck up some of that excess production. And so that's how we're contributing towards the grid resiliency, as I mentioned, turning off, but also towards consuming these energy costs that have the lowest cost of energy. Because in Bitcoin mining, as I mentioned, our cost, 80% of it's energy. And so we're always looking to reduce that, which means we're not going after the electrons in New York City. We're not going after electrons where everyone wants them. We're going to the middle of the Midwest, where the towns are 300 people and you have to drive, you know, 3 or 4 hours from the airport. We're going to spots that are very, very rural and that have an excess amount of energy and lack of population. So that energy, they're still getting the tax credits, but it might not actually be helping the community out as much. And so that's why we go to those areas and why we build facilities in Iowa.
Yeah, and you know, another thing is, you know, for example, if that town that you're in sort of grows too big, you know, there's sort of two solutions. Either the energy suppliers, you know, build more wind farms or solar farms, or you can just potentially relocate to somewhere where there is, again, cheaper energy. Because, you know, when one place gets too big, there's going to be somewhere else in the country or in that state, in that area, that has, you know, too few people for the amount of energy it's producing. So, you know, what you're doing is you're giving that capacity for that area to actually grow. You're saying, yes, you may be producing too much for what you need now, but we will help support you. We'll take that, you know, we'll take that load off of you, and we can give it back to you as soon as you're ready. Just give us a call and be like, yo, we need it now. And you can give it back to them. So if that town starts to develop, starts to grow, you know, that grid may not have enough to actually support you guys, at which point you guys may be like, all right, cool. We can find somewhere else. We can find somewhere that's offering perhaps a cheaper price now, because obviously you're bidding against the everyday people now. And, you know, the everyday people will probably get a preference as well. They'll probably get, you know, some benefits. I say the everyday people, rather it would be, you know, the local government, bidding on their behalf. So, you know, you have that sort of flexibility where you're giving these places capacity to actually grow and develop. And I think that's really interesting because, you know, over time you can have towns, or like you said, you know, they're building dams in developing countries where, you know, they can extract as much value as they can, and value that would otherwise go wasted. And then, you know, once the time is right, you can actually just shut it off, and that town is now, you know, fully sufficient. They're not wasting a lot. And then you can just move to the next operation where you develop a new town or city. And, you know, I think, you know, in terms of like social development, that's really, really great.
You're exactly right. And I think the biggest difference you mentioned earlier in the podcast, which is energy is really hard to store and it needs to be used right now. It's one of the only assets like that, you know, energy and water. You can store oil, you can store corn, you can store any of these other commodities. But when it comes to electricity, storing it is a, as we see, it's much harder than it is to, we use a lot more than we can store. Let's just say that.
Yeah, no, definitely. I want to move on to sort of the Bitcoin mining space. You know, I'm sure you guys have a lot of competitors. I won't name any, but how do you guys sort of differentiate yourself from some of the other competitors on the market? You know, I know some of them are on, you know, the stock exchange. I don't think you guys are. You know, how are you guys sort of differentiating yourself from what you do and what they do?
Yeah, so at the end of the day, we're in a commoditized business. We all provide a similar service, which would be running your Bitcoin miners. I would say how we are different is we are looking to work with the client in a white glove solution, in a contractual solution that's going to ensure that you're going to be able to win in a bull market and in a bear market. Because I've been in this space for so long, I've had my gripes and I've had my legal battles with hosting companies where you go put machines in there and you, first of all, you know, let's say the operator's new and they're not able to run all these servers, and so they have servers down, or you're not able to pay your bill because the server, the price of that Bitcoin that you're mining goes too low and your servers are old. And then it's like, what happens when you can't pay a power bill? Well, most companies will say you have to keep paying that through. And if you don't pay this bill, you're never going to get your machines back again because they're now ours because you defaulted. And so we've worked on our contracts where you can't actually default in that sense for our managed mining and our Bitvault clients. Because they're profit sharing contracts and they're at a low cost of energy or our cost, we allow the customer to basically live through the bear market and enjoy the bull market without having the ability to default and lose their machines. So that's one of the biggest reasons how we are different, how we approach the market is I'm not looking to, you know, take advantage of a new miner coming in who doesn't know what they're getting into, who signs a really high energy rate contract, and then they're making a lot of money in the beginning, but then as the time goes on, they can't survive because it's too high a cost of energy. The operator gets their machines, and that's the name of the game. It's been a 4-year cycle in Bitcoin mining.
Yeah.
There's high, very high highs and very low lows because Bitcoin price moves very quickly, but people can only deploy infrastructure so fast. And that's why you have this disparity. And then you have people, as we saw in the past year, like with NYDIG and their loans, you have these big lenders who did $100 million plus loans, and then they got defaulted on, and these companies are still running the machines against their people that lent them, right? They're now becoming a competitor. So the lender becomes a direct competitor to everyone who he lent money to, and is now taking away their profits by running their machines themselves. And so this comes into this pizza that's only so big, and only so many people can get access to that pizza. And so we like to work with the group to get access to that pizza versus saying, hey, you know, we're just going to take a high energy rate and a high service rate, and it's up to you to, you know, to make it work.
Okay. Yeah, no, that definitely makes a lot of sense. You know, you're sort of taking on that shared responsibility of, you know, you help give us the capital, we'll do all the operational side. And, you know, at the end of the month, we will take whatever we need to pay for the bills and the services, and then the rest will literally send it to your wallet. So it's in your hands, you know, it's under your control. So it's sort of like a monthly dividend cash flowing business, you know, where at the end of the month, you do your accounts, you're like, all right, cool, we've made X amount in Bitcoin. And then it's up to that individual whether they want to sell that Bitcoin straight away, or if they want to, you know, accumulate it for, another time. And, you know, it gives people that flexibility of effectively investing in a cash flowing business where they have the option of holding their asset as Bitcoin or holding it in cash. And I think that's quite a unique model, because, you know, a lot of, for example, the companies on the stock exchange, you buy their shares and, you know, you may get paid some dividends, but at the end of the day, you're hoping that their business is profitable over the long term, where you can eventually sell your shares and get your money out. But this way, you're sort of getting a bit back every month. And I would say, for me at least, it kind of gives me like more confidence that, you know, every month I know I'm getting X percent back from my original investment. So after, you know, a year, 2 years or 3 years, I'm completely paid out. And anything after that is just like pure profit for me. So I think that model is very unique.
And the one thing I'll mention as well is, like, we're not consolidating the people together saying like, oh, you're now joining like a bunch of other miners in the company. No, your computers work just for you, no one else. And when that's happening, you know, you're getting directly paid from that. And then in addition, I was going to say something else, but I forgot it.
No worries. So how does that work? So if, you know, I bought, you know, X number of machines, are all your machines running together in a pool, or are they all running in their own, you know, mini pools, you know, with, just like,
yeah,
you know,
so it's all pooling. in one Lux. We run with Luxor Pool.
Yep.
And the guys over there, and then we split it up into each one has a worker name, which is like a unique identifier to track your account. And then you have this unique identifier, the machines run to that account, you get paid out of that account, and that's how we track it. And then the nice thing about it is, versus investing in a public company or another pubco, as you mentioned, you know the management fees are defined. You know, Core Scientific last year had the highest priced, or the most amount of money was spent on private jets from this Bitcoin mining company, out of any public company and of the whole stock market, right? So you as a shareholder don't really necessarily have say into how that mining company is going to manage all the Bitcoin miners. Yes, you're going to get the low cost of power. Yes, you're going to get exposure to thousands of machines, and you're not going to have one or two machines that could fail, but you don't have as much control. So it's a trade-off between flexibility and appreciation and control and cash flow, as you mentioned.
Totally. I think, you know, we've sort of made our way through our list of questions that we had. I had, you know, one more question. It's, I guess it comes into the philosophy of what like decentralization actually is. A lot of people say, you know, or I've seen on Twitter, oh, Bitcoin is centralized because, you know, X percent of miners belong to one pool. You know, what is your take on that?
So my take on that is, at the software layer, yes, you know, we have had scares with Bitcoin mining and pools over the years, but a pool is not physical infrastructure in the ground. So machines can easily be redirected. I can move, you know, tens of thousands of servers within a minute to a new pool, and they can start working on that pool. And if there was a chance that we'd get a 51% attack. And so that's the same thing, you know, that's why mining is different, because you can really do that with nodes and with staking, because that's really easy to turn up. Each one is, you know, without putting aside the Ethereum you need to put up or the coin you need to stake, it's very cheap to do. You know, putting up a server using Google, Amazon, like most of those services host most of the nodes and most of the staking nodes. And so that's not decentralized, in my opinion. When you have decentralized infrastructure, which is mining units across the whole world scattered everywhere, that's very, very hard for a government to take out a single spot, to put in regulation to stop it, because they know that they're just going to impact the guys here, but it's not going to affect the whole system. And that this system is so resilient that it'll keep making Bitcoin blocks. So it's like, you know, TikTok making a block every 10 minutes, Bitcoin miners out here, close it up with a quick wrap. I don't know.
No, for sure. You know, I think it's quite interesting, you know, I think it comes down to the sort of friction of changing who you're, you know, associated with, right? With Bitcoin mining, yes, you may be associated with a pool, and, you know, pooling only happens because it makes, you know, resources more efficient. You're working together towards a goal, but it's literally, you know, a single command, or, you know, a handful of commands within, like you said, a minute, and you can redirect all of your miners to your own pool. So, you know, if the pool that you are associated with happens to go rogue, you can easily pull your resources out of it at a moment's notice. And, you know, you can do that again with some, you know, proof of stake consensus mechanisms as well, where you can unstake. But again, some of these staking mechanisms have a unstaking period where, you know, there's 28 days before your assets actually become unstaked. So if there is, you know, a bad validator who has, you know, 51%, that is a very long time before you can actually take power out of their hands. Or in, you know, for example, the case of Ethereum, there's actually a withdrawal wait time where, you know, if you want to unstake, you need to wait a certain amount of time. And I think this problem is a little bit more like expressed through the fact that a lot of Ethereum staking is happening through these services. You know, there's a lot of services where you just deposit your Ethereum, however much you have. It doesn't need to be 32, it can be half an Ethereum, and they handle the rest of it. So you're giving all of your Ethereum to, you know, a DAO, an entity, and they're doing the legwork to separate up that Ethereum into different nodes, and you're sort of relying on them to be decentralized and be honest, rather than if you're hosting your own infrastructure. If someone else goes rogue, that doesn't really affect you, or you can just change who you're associated with at a moment's notice. So I think, you know, the debate for me comes down to, you know, friction. You know, how quickly can you change who you're being associated with? And I think it, you know, the definition of decentralization sort of just differs between person to person. Something that's, you know, decentralized for one person doesn't, you know, always mean the same thing to someone else. So, you know, I think it is like a very difficult conversation, because it's very hard to have a one size fits all sort of metric to measure decentralization. But yeah, no, that was just one of the things I wanted to ask you, because, you know, you're obviously in that space, and it's one that I see pop up time and time again. Yeah, so I think Ink, it is very interesting. yeah, no, for sure. How do you feel about, or what do you see the future of Bitcoin mining being, especially in the US? You know, recently the SEC has gone heavy after Binance and Coinbase in early this week. Do you think that's going to eventually come after Bitcoin mining, or what's your take on that?
So I would say, I think Bitcoin mining will continue to have good roots in the United States and will continue to grow. One is recently started to be producing more energy than we consume in the United States. The Infrastructure Act is going to provide even more cheap energy to the wholesale markets, where power providers or Bitcoin miners, because they're sophisticated energy buyers, can get access to. So that's only going to decrease the cost of production. I think that, you know, we did see the 30% tax be floated on Bitcoin mining, which was dropped in the budget bill. You know, you mentioned the SEC. The reason, you know, why I don't think Bitcoin miners are as scared of the SEC as other token operators is because Bitcoin has been declared a commodity, and, you know, by the SEC, it's the only coin that they've made a statement on. And Bitcoin miners are physical infrastructure. So physical items, you're buying a computer, you know, you're hosting that computer. That's a very defined business that's been defined for years with the telecom guys, with Google, with Microsoft, of owning rack space and having other people run your rack space. And so if there is this sense of like, oh, you know, by running other people's computers, now you're operating a security, it's like you're opening up this Pandora box of, well, that's how the whole internet works. Like Microsoft, you know, hosts, Amazon hosts all these servers. You know, we run the servers for the people. And so that's how I would, how I view it. And then also, I think there's a lot to be said about freedom of expression and freedom of speech here in the United States. And code is an expression of speech, and code has been protected under speech. And so we are effectively running code on computers. And I would say that's an extension of us expressing free speech in the United States. And we're expressing the right to use that energy without any constraints or people telling us what we can and can't run on our computers. You know, we saw with OFAC address, but that's a little bit different. We're not there yet, but they haven't gone to saying, no, you can't run this software on your computer. You know, we didn't ban uTorrent and make it illegal to run uTorrent. We just said, you know, we're going to go after the guys who are making it accessible for people to find these torrents. So mm-hmm. that's kind of how the, you know, protocol argument versus service argument. Yes, services like cloud hashing services, they will get SEC subpoenaed. They have been. And that's because you're buying a security. And that's why, you know, we made it very clear with Bitvault, hey, you're buying a security. Let's do it through the regulated way. Let's make it available through the regulated method with the proper disclosures so you can get exposure. But this is a security. You don't own a Bitcoin miner when you own a Bitvault share. Mm. You own a security in a company that owns Bitcoin miners.
Yeah.
Right. So there's a very big difference.
Yeah. No, for sure. I'm just wary of time. Just before we wrap up, JP, where can people find out more about you and Mining Store? This is where you're gonna tag yourself or just shout out yourself.
Sure. So miningstore.com is where you can find more about us. Bitvault on WeFunder is where you can find more about the Reg CF. Should be going live in a few weeks. Myself, you can find me on Twitter, JP Barrick, on Instagram, John Paul Barrick, on TikTok, JP Barrick. Put out a bunch of content, make some funny videos, and we're gonna start educating and just putting out more informational content as we move forward. So thanks again for the time. This was amazing. I appreciate it. It's such a good conversation about energy and mining, and always gets me excited in the morning.
Yeah, perfect. No, thank you for actually joining me and reaching out. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.